Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 6th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's episode, I just want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible over the last week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's mostly because of the support of listeners just like you. So this week, I want to thank our top supporters, Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Daniel Lang, and David J.E. Smith. Thank you all so freaking much. If you're interested in pledging your support, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, let's talk about this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to sit down with a freelance science journalist and editor. His name is Keith Cooper. He's actually the editor and lead writer of Astronomy Now magazine. He's also previously worked as the editor of Astrobiology magazine. He's written for New Scientist, Physics World, Science Focus, Sky and Telescope. Are you guys noticing a theme? And he's got a new book out called The Contact Paradox, Challenging Our Assumptions in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Ooh. So we're going to talk all about that. What is SETI? How far have they come? And how does the work that we do in attempting to send out or potentially receive messages or forms of contact to alien civilizations tell us a lot about ourselves and our place in the universe? So guys, without any further ado, here he is, Keith Cooper. Well, Keith, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to talking about your new book, which came out earlier this year, The Contact Paradox, Challenging Our Assumptions in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And this is a topic that I think is really near and dear to a lot of people, this idea of, are we alone in the universe? If we're not alone in the universe, not only, you know, how much should we be looking for other life, but what are the ways that we should be looking for other life? But you go even deeper into the questions and you really focus on some of these moral and humanistic and kind of ethical questions about, like, not just technically how should we be doing it, but ethically how should we be doing it? That's the part I'm so excited to talk to you about today.
Sure. I mean, you know, when people often talk about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, what we call SETI, you know, it's often from a scientific viewpoint of, you know, how we're going to send a message across light years to, you know, planets around other stars and vice versa, and the technology we're going to use to detect those messages. But, you know, it's often said that if we detected a signal from, you know, a civilization or a society out there, that, you know, it would be one of the biggest moments in human history. And, you know, that brings with it a lot of consequences, and we don't maybe talk about the consequences of what that contact moment would have in store for us. So, and those consequences include, you know, ethical or moral consequences, you know, societal consequences, as well as scientific. And, you know, yeah, that was a whole sort of landscape of topics that they have been touched on in the literature, but in terms of, you know, books and things aimed at, you know, the layperson, that it's rarely touched upon. And that was something that I wanted to really get into with the book.
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the big things that I often, I don't know, grapple with, there's a trope, and I actually think it's a valid trope, but I remember once getting into, not an argument, but having a conversation with Steve Novella, who's the host of the other podcast I work on, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, after we did a deep dive into the film Arrival. And I remember we were saying, you know, I thought it was a really well done film, and they really kind of handled a lot of things how, I don't know, obviously it's science fiction, so who knows, but fictionally, how I think things might be handled in this situation. And he was like, oh, I hate the trope where they always send the military first. And I'm like, no, that's probably what they would do. And that's the part that really worries me, is that this idea of, you know, is there intelligent life somewhere else in the universe? And if we ever were in a position technologically to be able to interface with it, would we come across as a hostile force? And I don't know, man, especially in light of the social context that we're in right now, but honestly, I think in light of most of human history, I very much worry that we would come across as a very hostile force.
Possibly. I mean, I haven't seen Arrival, but I get the gist of it.
Oh, no, you must watch.
I know. So it had gone from Netflix by the time I subscribed to it.
Yeah.
So. I mean, certainly, you know, I think the gist of it was spacecraft come and land on Earth. And I think sending the military as a, you know, in a defensive posture, you know, seems like a natural thing to do. I mean, we were assuming there that the aliens wouldn't know or understand, you know, violence or hostility or you know, the willingness to defend yourself. Right. You know, so maybe I think when we worry about that trope, we're perhaps thinking that aliens are going to be a little bit naive, that they expect us to be all peaceful. I mean, the reality is that if there is an alien society out there, they're likely a lot older than we are. I mean, the universe is nearly 14 billion years old, and, you know, Earth-like planets have been able to form, you know, the materials to build Earth-like planets have been around for 10, 11 billion years. So, you know, an alien society could be billions of years older than us. I don't think they'd be too concerned about our tanks and methods of warfare. So it might be that, you know, they consider that all irrelevant anyway, that they're completely impervious to us. Maybe they don't, you know, we're too low down on the evolutionary scale for them to show much interest in us. But you're right. I think that often, you know, our instincts are, you know, let's throw the army at them, or let's assume that they're going to be hostile. And that could lead to perhaps misunderstandings in contact events. You know, was it the film Mars Attacks where the aliens, the Martians, interpret, was it applause as a threatening behavior?
Right.
And yeah, they react to that. So yeah, there's lots of opportunity, I think, for misunderstandings in contact between two societies that, you know, by the very, very definition of the word, are alien to one another. We can look at human history and contact events just between human societies, and we can see where misunderstandings have arisen, you know, through differences in culture and society. So that would just be exacerbated, you know, if we were to encounter an alien society that has a completely different culture. It's got, you know, they've had a completely different evolutionary history. You know, who knows what their society would be like, what they would consider threatening, what they wouldn't, whether they would be threatening to us or not care. So, yeah, so all these unknowns, and I think in SETI, and when we discuss about, you know, making contact with extraterrestrial life, we look to science fiction and what's happened in science fiction, Star Trek or whatever. And we almost think it's going to be like that the aliens are going to be like Klingons or Vulcans or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just don't know what we're going to be dealing with. There's a lot of unknowns. So I think, you know, the moment that we do make contact, if it ever does happen, I think caution needs to be the order of the day until we can get a better understanding of what it is we're dealing with. Even if it's, you know, benevolent, as I say, you know, misunderstandings could lead to, you know, all kinds of shenanigans that may be bad for us. So, you know, it does have a lot of consequences, and we haven't given enough time to really think through what those consequences are. So in my book, I just wanted to raise some of those issues and the things that we don't know and the things that could cause us trouble in the future.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously so many unknowns with regard to a question of this magnitude. And I think probably there's a handful of people who maybe haven't taken the time to think about these issues or, just really like don't read about this topic very often, or it's not sort of a topic that's in their main wheelhouse or interest area, who might approach a conversation about not just extraterrestrial intelligence, but the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the parameters around that search, with a little bit of kind of sneering, kind of like, why are we talking about this? Is this even a real issue? How do you really respond? Because I know that you've been working as a science journalist for quite some time, and really your beat is astronomy, astrobiology, this area. How do you respond to people who are like, why are we even having this conversation?
It's a good question. And certainly, you know, given what's going on in the world at the moment, it does feel like, you know, SETI is fairly low down on the list of, you know, things we should be concerned about or interested in. But I opened my book talking about William Proxmire. Your listeners over in the US will probably know who he is, a Democratic senator, I think in the 70s and the 80s. And he had his Golden Fleece Awards, where anything that he saw as a waste of public money, he would highlight and try and, you know, award them this ironic Golden Fleece Award for wasting money. And SETI, yeah, was, you know, one of his targets. He thought it was a complete waste of money. And Carl Sagan, obviously he was very interested in SETI, and he spoke to Proxmire, you know, and he said, because Sagan and Proxmire were both, you know, very anti-nuclear war, and you know, he started from that kind of perspective, you know, how can we avoid blowing ourselves up? And Sagan said, well, if we did detect, you know, a society, a civilization out there that was older than us and gone through, you know, this kind of bottleneck of existential risk, that, you know, we could learn from them perhaps about how they avoided blowing themselves up. And it would give us confidence that, you know, it's not inevitable that we're going to blow ourselves up either. So I would answer that question by saying, you know, if we discovered somebody out there, it would help put us in context, you know, who we are, where we're going, where we've come from. And that might just help us a little bit to figure out, you know, what we're doing, you know, where we're going as a society, you know, what the future holds for us. Because at the moment, you know, it's all that kind of stuff, you know, is all kind of cloudy. Look at the coronavirus epidemic that, you know, it's come along. It's almost come out of the blue for a lot of people and hit us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we spend enough time thinking about the future, thinking about the existential risks, thinking about, you know, if we can avoid blowing ourselves up or wiping ourselves out, what the potential is for humanity. And I just think a detection, you know, a SETI detection would just put us in context with, you know, the universe a little bit, and it would point to, you know, if an alien civilization can prosper and become, I hate to use the word advanced, but certainly long lived and you know, technologically developed and be able to do all the wondrous things that, you know, maybe they can do, then it would just give us a little bit more confidence in what the future holds for us, that maybe we can get to that level as well. So I think that's probably, yes, I don't know whether I've put that across particularly eloquently, but I think the gist of that is you know, that you know, it could have a lot of meaning for us as a species.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that's why your approach to talking about this subject is so intriguing to me, and why I wanted to have this conversation with you. You know, if I'm being 100% honest, 100% frank, because my background is mostly in social sciences, so and biological sciences, neuroscience, psychology. When I often, like on the SGU, the other podcast I work on, the guys, especially Bob, and to some extent Steve and Jay, they are very, very, very interested in astronomy, astrophysics, and there's almost always at least one kind of cosmology story that we cover weekly on the show. And I've got to be honest, like sometimes when it gets so technical and when these conversations, they start to feel incredibly esoteric. I think that's the best word I can choose. And it saddens me that I think of it that way, or that that's my first emotional response to it. But it's, it, it does really start to feel very distant from the problems that we deal with here on Earth and from kind of core humanitarian or just humanistic issues. And so bringing that part of the conversation into a discussion about, you know, whether or not there is life out there in the cosmos and what would really happen if and when we approach it, that's what interests me most. But it's also something where it's like hard for me to fathom that it's not the first thing everybody is talking about when we talk about this issue. Like, it's hard for me to fathom that many people are like, we'll deal with that later, you know?
I love science fiction. I think science fiction can really inform SETI, but I do think science fiction also put into a lot of people's minds that the concept of aliens is fiction. And I think that's how a lot of people see it. But I think just going back to what you were saying there about the esoteric nature of certain aspects of cosmology or whatever. My background is astrophysics as well. But when I came to write the book, I mean, I could have written a book just about radio telescopes and about how to send messages and all being technical. And I wouldn't have learned a great deal from writing it. And I wanted to learn new things. I don't see the point of, you know, spending 10 years nearly writing a book if I'm not going to learn something from it. And if the readers aren't going to learn something from it, I looked at all the literature in SETI and went to the conferences and started to pick up where there were differences of opinion. And occasionally you'd have an anthropologist like Catherine Denning at the University of Toronto. People like that who would have a slightly different viewpoint. And I kind of thought, here's an angle for me to approach the topic at and to learn some new things and to bring other areas of science into the discussion, which I think is really needed because, you know, there's a lot of astrophysicists talking about SETI, but, you know, we need evolutionary biologists, sociologists, historians. You know, if we're going to understand contact and how contact may play out, we need to bring everybody into this discussion. So that's what I wanted to do. And hopefully, for readers who are reading the book, you know, even if their background isn't in radio astronomy or whatever, that they will find something in there that, you know, will you know, that they can relate to, that's you know, from maybe their background or you know, just something that they can... something more grounded than, you know, just talking about radio signals passing between planets. Right. The other thing as well is that I think you mentioned the esoteric nature of cosmology and all that kind of stuff, and it can get very abstract, you know, especially when you're talking about things like string theory and what have you. But I think it's all connected because when we study the universe and try and figure out how it works, the question we're usually asking, even if we're not overtly asking it, is why is the universe the way it is? And when we say why is the universe the way it is, what we really mean is why are we here? Why do we exist? Why is the universe made in such a way that we can exist here? So it's talking about life even then. So I think it's all connected. And I think if we, you know, if scientists and anyone interested in science, you know, starts, you know, if we could start to recognize that and just bring these different disciplines together and realize that there are links between them all, then, I think that would help, you know, place cosmology into better context for people. It would help place things like SETI and astrobiology into context as well with other areas of science. They're not separate areas. And that was something, you know, that I came to realize writing the book that, you know, all these different areas of you know, things that relate to SETI are connected. It's very multidisciplinary, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I mean, I think anybody who listens to the show regularly probably knows something about me to this point and knows that that's probably why, you know, your book interests me so much, because my focus in my PhD right now is on existential psychotherapy. And like these, it's really the existential issues that speak to me the most. Like you said, these big questions about, you know, why are we here? Where are we going? How did we come from nothing? And is there meaning? And if not, how can we make meaning out of meaninglessness? And contextualizing ourselves as individuals in a family, or families in a society, or societies on the globe, or, you know, human beings in the cosmos, I think is important. And that's the one place we haven't really been able to do. I think this kind of exceptionalism of the human species has been pervasive throughout much of human history. And of course, exacerbated by, you know, certain religions or certain kind of social structures. And there's something that there's a lot to be said for if we were to contact another species somewhere else in the cosmos, the amount of real hard reflection that we would have to do as human beings about that kind of exceptionalism, I think is a really important thing that, I mean, I hope many people are doing it now, but I'm not sure that they would without being confronted directly.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a topic that is often covered in science fiction. How, you know, what does it mean to be human in a universe full of life? And similarly, what does it mean to be human in a universe that has no life? I mean, we don't know if there's anyone or anything out there. You know, the universe could be dead except for this little oasis of life here, right here on Earth. You know, and I think whatever the answer is, it's profound. And, you know, I think science fiction addresses these issues quite a lot. So even, you know, if you just watch Star Trek, I think you're subconsciously, you know, watching this question being played out. You know, what is it like to be a human in a universe with other life, other cultures? But, you know, yeah, it's not something that is overtly talked about, even in SETI. I think a lot of SETI scientists that are definitely a lot happier just, you know, talking about the technology rather than the other aspects. And to a point, I mean, that's okay at the moment because we haven't detected any life out there.
Right, it feels a bit cart before the horse, but it's also kind of like we'd better be ready when, if and when. So there's sort of this, yeah, two sides to it.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not ready at all. If we detected a signal tomorrow, I mean, it depends what kind of signal it is. If, you know, the chances are that it's not going to be in English. So if we detect a signal, we may never be able to decipher it. It depends how you know, what kind of information that the sender wants to transmit and how easy they want to make it for us. So, you know, if we detected a signal from, I don't know, 1,000 light years away and we couldn't decipher it, we couldn't make head or tail, or we knew it was artificial, then, you know, the effects on the world may be, wow, that's cool. Some religions may have to rethink certain things, you know, and certainly those of us who like, you know, blue sky thinking and thinking about, you know, humanity in context will certainly find that important. But, you know, for the average person on the street who's just going to work, coming home, you know, looking after their kids, having dinner, it's not going to dramatically affect their lives. On the other hand, if the contact is one where, you know, we are able to get some information from it, perhaps they send us some technology or, you know, some information that changes something about, you know, what we know about science or how we might live our lives, then that's obviously a different kettle of fish. So, yeah, I think there's a whole scale there of different kinds of contact, and, you know, different consequences of that contact. So, you know, I think what history has taught us through looking at you know, contact events between human civilizations and what's gone on there is that, you know, there's no one size fits all kind of paradigm to contact events. So it's hard to know what to expect, you know, and that's why I think, you know, we want to get more historians and anthropologists into SETI so that they can, you know, run this full, you know, all these contact events between human civilizations throughout history, from the Europeans going to the Americas to, you know, people going over to the Far East, you know, even sort of modern day, you know, encounters with tribes in the Amazon or wherever. And just to kind of catalog and understand all of these contact events and look for commonalities and things like that. So at least we have some kind of preparation for contact with an extraterrestrial civilization should it ever happen.
Right. And I think one of the things that I've been grappling with more and more, you know, as we really do contextualize social unrest and we contextualize a diversity of voices, which what has really dominated a lot of kind of what we think of as modern Western science, you know, I just had a kind of deep conversation with Angela Saini about, you know, the history of sort of pseudoscience and the history of like women in science and how they've been denigrated and thought to be inferior and just these base assumptions. And one of the things that I struggle with sometimes when I read about astronomy or when I talk to people about astronomy, especially with regards to things like the Planet B models, like if we ever want to leave this planet or going to Mars or, you know, having first contact with other civilizations, is that we have a really dark colonial past that we need to grapple with. And my biggest concern is that that colonial mentality is not gone from the basically stakeholders, the people who are in the most powerful positions to be making decisions about these kinds of things. And as long as SETI is, you know, predominantly made up of white Western men, I think that we're just going to be doomed to repeat very dangerous mistakes that we've historically made. And that's why not just do we need, I think, you know, the anthropologists and the social scientists, but also a diversity of voices, of indigenous voices, of, you know, ethnic minority voices who have really, I think, experienced the negative side, the real dark consequences of our colonial history, and can bring some of that, not just context, but reckoning to these conversations. Because I don't think that, I don't think that they are irrelevant. I think that they're actually pointedly relevant. And for some reason, I just don't see these conversations taking place very often, especially within these fields.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think if you were to take a picture of all the main players in SETI at the moment, it would look very monotone, you know, a lot of white men. There are more women becoming involved, but even then, you know, it tends to be, SETI tends to be mostly an American endeavor. Russia, the Soviet Union used to do a lot of it back in the day, not so much now. Even in Europe, it's not a big thing. So it does tend to be focused mostly in the United States. And, you know, I spoke to an astronomer in Japan a couple of weeks ago who was doing SETI, and I asked him about SETI in Japan. And sadly, that, you know, again, they don't do much of it there. And I was hoping, you know, to get some insights from a different culture about, you know, how they see SETI as opposed to how Americans see SETI. And something I've been looking at lately is in China, they have the new FAST telescope, this big 500-meter bowl, a bit like Arecibo radio telescope, and they're doing SETI experiments on that. And they're working with Dan Wertheimer at the University of Berkeley. So it's a very international affair where Americans and Chinese astronomers are working on this SETI project. But when you look at the media and when they're talking about China's SETI project, they're not interested in, you know, what Chinese astronomers might be able to bring to SETI. They're more like, you know, the Chinese are going to keep it secret if they detect something and what have you. And it's very, you know, we're almost falling back on to the, you know, those whole kind of cliched international relationships. And there doesn't, you know, we need to strengthen those international ties and to really ask people, you know, in other parts of the world, how they see SETI. Because, you know, there might be something obvious that we're kind of overlooking that, you know, someone somewhere else in the world, they might have a different point of view and it might, we should try that or we should think about this. And again, it also goes back to, you know, the various contact events in human history. You spoke of colonialism, you know, it tended to be the Europeans doing that. And it's mostly European descendants now, the United States doing SETI. Well, let's ask some of the people whose countries we colonized, you know, how did they see contact? You know, was it that great for them really? And so, yeah, and this is a nice thing about SETI is that it doesn't even matter really in some respects whether there is anybody out there. Just by doing SETI, we can learn so much about ourselves, our own history, mm-hmm. our own behavior, and come to understand ourselves better as well. And even if there's no aliens, I think just understanding ourselves is worth the while.
Absolutely. All right, everyone. I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsor of this week's episode, the International Science Journal, Nature. Nature is so important. I cite them literally all the time. You'll notice that a lot of the stories that I share on social media are from Nature. I also utilize Nature to do research for my podcast, but also for my academic work as well. And that's because Nature is the leader in the latest global science research. They're really the world's foremost international weekly scientific journal, 150 years old at this point. That's amazing. And it's not just landmark peer-reviewed papers. It's also award-winning news, leading comment, and expert opinion on all sorts of science. So if you subscribe, you get so much great stuff, guys. You get 51 weekly print issues. So you've got like your magazine each week that you can catch up on, you know, full color, really glossy, a great way to kind of casually get a sampling of everything that's going on in the world of science. You also, of course, get online access to current issues and archived issues as far back as 1997. So not only can you look up all sorts of incredible science news, you can access what is new in the world right now in science and technology. And of course, for June and July, I have a really special offer just for you, the Talk Nerdy listeners. So if you go to go.nature.com/nerdy and subscribe to an annual subscription, you're going to get 50% off the original price. All you've got to do is visit go.nature.com/nerdy for 50% off. All right, everyone, let's get back to the show.
I mean, it really is like a giant mirror in many ways. You're so right. You know, I'm interested in your take if you were a betting man, and I'm sure you've been asked this question in most of your interviews. Or, you know, is it hopeful? Is it wishful thinking for you? Like, if you had to put your dollar down, do you think, you know, kind of in a deep existential way that we are, for all intents and purposes, alone? Do you think that there's a good chance there are other civilizations, but we're just never going to, you know, make contact with them? Or do you think that there's a chance that within your lifetime, maybe your grandchildren's lifetime, that we are going to, you know, have no more about the, I guess, diversity of the universe than we know right now?
I've got splinters in my backside from sitting on the fence on this issue.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. It's a toss of a coin, really. We don't understand how life evolved on Earth to begin with. So it's kind of, you know, we don't know whether life here is a fluke or not. If life evolved here as a complete fluke, then the chances are we are probably alone in the universe. On the other hand, maybe life was inevitable. Wherever, you know, there's habitable conditions, maybe life evolves. But then there's other questions of, you know, well, maybe microbial life evolves, but what about more complex life, intelligent life? And then, you know, how do we define intelligence? If the universe is full of dolphins, you know, yeah. Would we see that as a universe full of intelligence or not? I personally would, but it would be a different kind of intelligence. SETI looks for technological intelligence. So I guess I think we'll find microbial life elsewhere in the universe. I think we could possibly find it elsewhere in the solar system. But when it comes to looking for more complex life, I really don't know. I hope so. But... you know, it's at the moment it's 50-50, I think. And then, you know, the other thing to consider is maybe we are alone in the universe now, but, you know, in the past there may have been other alien civilizations that have died off, and all that is left is their ruins. Right. So we could still be alone, but life might not be unique, if you see what I mean.
Because we're pretty new in the grand scheme of things, even though we're so old, like you mentioned, yeah. Like we're a fourth of the age of the universe. Like, there could be, you're right, so many civilizations that have risen and fallen before us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just Earth being a third of the age of the universe, third or fourth of the age of the universe.
Exactly. You know,
modern humans have been around, what, about 100,000 years at the most?
Exactly.
And modern society is, goes back about 10,000 years. It's absolutely nothing. So we are babies in a sort of a cosmological perspective. I think it's arrogant to assume that we understand everything about the universe. We certainly don't. There's a lot we don't understand. And we're looking for life out there, and it's very parochial because we're looking for life like we have life here on Earth. And we just have no idea what a billion years of evolution can do to life. What its goals would be, what it would transform into. We just don't know. I think SETI, when people think of SETI, I think it's about looking for kind of Star Trek type life. And it could just be so out of our context that we may not even recognize it. Not even recognize us. It could be machine life, for example. It could have, who knows? It could have all this, they could have gone down black holes to some other universes. They could have gone up into some kind of virtual reality universe, uploaded themselves into some kind of hive mind, or we have no idea. I mean, it's just completely speculative what that life would be like. And that's where, when SETI doing radio SETI or looking for laser beams, we're constraining ourselves a lot by just looking for what we know about, which is a sensible approach to begin with, because, we can only look for what we know exists and what we would recognize. But I think, so I'm not criticizing that approach, but I think we also have to accept that there's this big phase space of possibilities that we don't even know how to look for. So just because, radio SETI doesn't turn up anything doesn't really mean anything. That just tells us aliens aren't sending radio signals, but it doesn't tell us they don't exist and aren't doing something different that we just haven't thought of yet.
So as a journalist, kind of your approach as somebody who's knowledgeable about these issues and reads about them a lot, I'm wondering, do you tend on the more kind of hopeful optimistic or more kind of like pessimistic, cynical side when you hear, let's say, or you're doing coverage of an article about a fast radio burst that has like an odd periodicity or something like that? Like, are you like, ooh, could be aliens? Or are you like, come on, guys, like, this is definitely not alien.
I guess there's a little part of my mind that always thinks, oh, I hope it's aliens. But yeah. I mean, fast radio bursts are really interesting just from an astrophysical point of view. I've just been doing a little write-up for my website about false alarms in SETI and go back to the 60s when pulsars were discovered. At first, they thought maybe these could be aliens. Instead, it was a huge astrophysical discovery of pulsars, these spinning neutron stars had never been seen before. I don't get disheartened by things like that because I think the astrophysics is really cool anyway. I think there was that whole thing a couple of years ago of a Bajajian star the astronomer Tabitha Bajajian helped find in the data from the Kepler Space Telescope. It had these odd dips in light as if something was orbiting the star, and I thought maybe this is some kind of alien megastructure because it was these really odd dips in light indicating a kind of swarm of giant objects. And, in the media then, in the newspapers and websites and things, people are saying, this could be aliens. It could be some megastructure that has been built like some kind of Dyson sphere or something like that. And, even scientists were, it could be, they didn't rule it out straight away. It turned out that what is blocking the light are huge clumps of dust. We still don't understand exactly where the dust has come from or even where it is, whether it's an orbit around the star or whether it's somewhere in the 1400 light years between us and the star. But, I think approaching it from a scientific perspective, you have to rule out every plausible natural explanation before you can even start to think this is aliens.
Yeah, right.
you can't just jump to conclusions because you just end up looking like an idiot when it turns out not to be aliens. But you have to do it scientifically and rigorously, you know, just rule everything else out. And then once you've ruled everything else out, then you can really start to think, okay, could this be aliens? And it might be, you know, we might detect something. Look at fast radio bursts. We still don't know exactly what is causing them. We're fairly sure that they're not aliens, but, you know, what they are is still a bit of a mystery. And it might be that we detect something that might be artificial, might be natural. We can't tell. And it could take decades to figure it out. So I don't think it's going to be a eureka moment, you know, where we detect a signal and it's really obvious. Hopefully it will be, but it could be, you know, it could be fairly vague for a long time. You know, some people thinking it's some kind of natural phenomena, other people thinking it's some kind of artificial phenomena. And there is a danger of jumping the gun a little bit and announcing aliens before you're sure. But at the same time, you know, if you're having to wait ages to try and figure it out, people get frustrated. I'm hopeful that you know, we will find something.
Well, it reminds me of those same kind of problems that of course the scientists working on these issues are grappling with regards to, like, not only how could we decipher, like, how can we make sense of a signal that we receive, but also in terms of the signals that we're putting out. Like, it really is the same kind of issue, which is, like, within the constraints of our language and our present knowledge and our technology, like, how do we communicate to a potential life form that does not, you know, necessarily have the same constraints. Like, and it reminds me too of the question that I think it's such an interesting question about these sites, like these salt mines, kind of these Permian salt mines in these different areas where we are disposing of nuclear waste. And it's like, well, how do we indicate 15,000 years, 20,000 years in the future, don't dig here, there's nuclear waste beneath the earth? Like, because who is going to be the one who has to read that signal? And how is it pictorial? Is it, you know, it's the golden record on Voyager. Like, how do you make those kinds of determinations about communication with potential life that might not have similar communication styles or might not have any?
Sure, absolutely. And that's a big issue. I mean, some scientists have said, well, maybe they'll use some kind of mathematical language because, as far as we're aware, mathematics is the same across the universe, which is fine. So maybe, you know, they use binary code or whatever and we could translate it. But like, we could understand the code, but would we understand the content of the message? I mean, how, mm-hmm. you know, it, how, you know, if we were going to design a message to send to extraterrestrials and we wanted to convey what it meant to be human, how do we do that? How, you know, to an alien life form that has a completely different biology and completely different culture, how do we convey what love is or what hate is or what, you know, all these human emotions are? They would have no context for it. And similarly, yeah. We wouldn't have any context for, you know, if they send us a message that is embedded within their own culture and their own evolution and their own biology. Even if they send pictures or videos, you know, we'd be looking at it thinking, you know, is that an arm? Is that a leg? Is that a head? What are we looking at? We'd have no Rosetta Stone to understand it. Mm-hmm. It's certainly going to be difficult, I think, to get over those first steps of contact. I mean, maybe if they're nearby, say they're 20, 30, 40 light years away, and they have a very big the detector, they may have picked up some of our radio leakage, you know, TV signals or whatever, and may have a general idea of what we're like and would be able to communicate with us more effectively. But our radio leakage is so weak anyway. It would be a tough ask for them to be able to detect that. And, you know, it would be this clash of biology and culture and sociology and ethics and all those things. And then, you know, on top of that, you've got the problem of just understanding and translating each other, that contact would be, you know, being able to communicate with them would be very difficult, I think. But you know, at the same time, just the knowledge that they're out there would be enormous.
Right. And I mean, I hate to harp on this because I think that it's going to be your homework tonight is to go home and watch Arrival. or I know I'm going to get like emails if I don't mention, of course, that it's based on the Ted Chiang story of your life short story, which is so beautiful. But I still recommend watching the film because it's divergent enough and lovely. But it speaks to kind of some of the same themes that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is that, you know, I'm not really a sci-fi lover. And anybody who listens to The Skeptic's Guide knows that the guys really pile on me because I like don't get any of their references, nor do I want to. But there are a handful of the science fiction storytelling approaches that I think grapple with these deeper human questions and in a way that is really meaningful to me. So, you know, we talk about First Contact. And of course, it evokes the cover of the book Contact by Carl Sagan and the film that Linda Oakes produced based on that. And similarly, Story of Your Life and Arrival. I think these science fiction stories grapple with some of these main issues in a more maybe sophisticated way, or at least they just don't ignore them, or they centralize them to the story in a way that I think is really... maybe sometimes ignored by the types of science fiction that I'm less interested in, or they become spread out amongst all of the fanfare and like, ooh, look at the cool blasters and laser guns, like that kind of stuff I'm less interested in. And so I think that that's something really cool that you mentioned has sort of spread into the culture and in some ways sort of planted a seed into the minds of people who may not be thinking about or grappling with some of these issues is that in sort of under the guise of like pure entertainment, these seeds are planted and these really big picture issues become points to grapple with that are very important points to grapple with for sure.
Sure. And with Arrival and certainly with the case with Contact, that is one film I have seen. you know, they're stories about aliens, but at their heart, they're stories about humans and what it means to be human. And, you know, that's the message I try and get across in my book, that the stars are like a mirror. And, you know, when we look out there to find life, we see ourselves reflected back. And I think by doing SETI, you know, we can learn so much about ourselves. And I think, you know, that kind of message that those particular stories put across is a really good one. You know, it's not just about weird, you know, people in rubber suits and blaster guns and things. As much as I like that kind of stuff, but, you know, it's you know, there is a deeper meaning to it. So you know, I would hope listeners, you know, if they're not really familiar with SETI, if they take one message home with them after listening to this, it's that SETI isn't just about looking for little green men. It's about looking for ourselves and who we are and just putting ourselves into context in the universe.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, before we kind of close out and I ask you the final two questions that I ask everybody who comes on my show, I would love to know from you, you know, you mentioned much earlier and I made a little note that because generally speaking in your work as a science journalist, especially one whose beat is mostly, you know, or is astronomy, you're often writing about these kind of technical issues. And when you challenged yourself with writing this book that focuses on some of these deeper questions, you were opening up an opportunity to learn and to ask the kinds of questions that you don't often get to dig deep into. So I'm just wondering, other than the things that we discussed in the show, is there anything that sticks out to you as something that you were surprised to learn or something that you really didn't think you would need to be grappling with, but the deeper you got into the research for the book, the more it became salient for you?
Yeah, definitely. I would say altruism and the nature of altruism is... I came away from writing the book thinking altruism is the most important thing in SETI, which might sound strange at first glance, but... So, you know, you often hear people working in SETI saying that, you know, these civilizations, millions, billions of years older than us, that, you know, they're going to be peaceful, they're going to be altruistic towards us. Mm-hmm. And when they say that, what they really mean is they're going to be nice towards us. But in nature, altruism, what I learned is that there's two main kinds of altruism in nature. There is kin altruism. So, you know, animals, people, whatever, that, you know, you'll do something for your kin, your children, your nieces, nephews. And that's really just to help propagate the genes, you know, into further, you know, you'll look after your children and defend your children so that they can pass their genes on to the next generation.
Yeah, there's an evolutionary benefit to that.
Absolutely, yes. And the other is a kind of a reciprocal altruism, you know, a quid pro quo. You do something for me, I do something for you. It's like, those little fish that clean the teeth of sharks. I can't remember what they're called. You know, that kind of relationship. And neither of those really work over interstellar distances. I mean, you know, we're not kin with aliens. The very definition of alien is something that is, you know, not our kin. So you know, we're not going to feel any kind of kinship necessarily with them, at least not at first. Maybe when we get to know them better, we'll, you know, become friends and want to look out for each other. And reciprocal altruism, well, it's hard to reciprocate across hundreds of light years. When, you know, you send a message, you might not receive a reply for millennia. So how is that going to work? And the thing that's not often talked about in SETI is that, you know, we're waiting to detect this radio message or this laser signal or whatever. It's rarely spoken about how much energy, how much resources the sender would have to put into beaming that message out into space for it to work. They probably don't know where we are. So they're having to send, you know, this message in all directions across hundreds, maybe thousands of light years. It gobbles up a huge amount of energy. They have to put a lot of resources, a lot of time into it. You know, maybe they have to transmit for centuries or millennia. And why would a civilization devote so many resources to such an activity? You know, they'd have to be incredibly altruistic towards us to want to do that. Either that, or they have lots and lots and lots of energy and resources, and you know, they'd barely notice, you know, what they're spending on transmitting. And also when it comes to contact itself, you know, when they're talking, you know, aliens will be altruistic towards us, they're going to be nice, but, you know, maybe not. Maybe they're more interested in looking after their own kin, or maybe they want something in return. And if we're not going to give them anything in return, they're not going to be interested in us. You know, even ethical behavior. Well, ethics, I think, depends, you know, on the society and the culture that you grow up in, you evolve in. And different cultures, you know, probably have slightly different ethics. You know, I spoke to someone from my book who pointed out that, you know, you could still be altruistic while engaging in warfare, because if the war, you know, if the result of the war is beneficial to your people, then aren't you then being altruistic to your own people by engaging in that war?
So, wow, interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, I came away from it thinking altruism is quite an important part of SETI and of, you know, what might happen if we make contact. And the way that a lot of SETI scientists throw the term altruism around is really misunderstanding what altruism is. And if we could understand that better in its context with SETI, it would perhaps better constrain our expectations of whether, you know, we expect to detect a signal or not, and what kind of effort the aliens would have to go to transmit that signal. And, you know, it would also help inform us when we do make that contact, you know, what to expect and what to look out for. So I think that's, you know, that I came away thinking that's a really big issue that isn't really being talked about much.
That's fascinating. Yeah. It always comes back to philosophy.
Yeah.
That's what I say all the time. Philosophy is so important. It's such a fundamental part of, I think, how we should be educating, you know, within our what we should be learning within our education systems. And it's something that I think we've moved away from, but I would love to see become more central to our focus on education.
Sure. Well, it's kind of, you know, a mix of, you know, cultural evolution and biological evolution. And, again, when we try and imagine what aliens are like, we talk about their biology and how many legs they may have or whatever, but we rarely think about their culture and how that has evolved and, you know, and how, you know, the environment that they've evolved in has affected their psychology and things like that. I think that was real eye-opener for me.
Yeah. Well, Keith, gosh, so many interesting questions to grapple with. So much like fascinating information. I would love, before we say goodbye, to ask you the same two questions that I always ask my guests, because I'm super interested in what your approach to answering these questions is going to be.
Okay.
All right. So I want to know, when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you, you know, obviously your work might inform that, but it could be your personal life, your family, what's going on in the world at large today. I want to know, number one, what is the thing that really does keep you up at night? The thing that you're most concerned about, maybe, you know, pessimistic, borderline cynical about. And then on the flip side of that, so we close on a higher note, what are you genuinely and authentically optimistic about? What are you really looking forward to?
So I think what I'm most afraid of is that we're going to do something stupid, really, really breathtakingly stupid. And, you know, all our potential just get wiped out in an instant. I read a book recently by Toby Ord, all about existential risk, called The Precipice. He's at the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford, and he's talking about all the different ways that we could either wipe ourselves out or curtail our potential. Because you know, there's a whole universe out there to explore and to grow into. And you know, I look around the world today, and you know, just look at this virus and our response to the virus is not being ideal. I don't think any country can be singled out as being particularly worse than the others. I think globally the reaction, the response has been pretty poor. And, you know, it's been a warning shot. I hate to call it a warning shot because so many people have died. But you know, if you speak to people who study pandemics and viruses like this, this has been coming, they say, and that, you know, we may, especially with climate change taking hold as well, that we may see more and more of these pandemics. And, you know, who's to say the next one won't be a lot worse? And then, you got concerns about weaponized viruses getting out, and then you got climate change on top of that. So, you know, our response to the virus hasn't given me much heart that, you know, we're learning lessons and we'll be better prepared next time for whatever we have to face. There is the concern that we just don't think about the consequences enough, and that we'll do something stupid, whether it's, you know, creating an AI that we can't control, or whatever. But on the other side, you know, if we can get through this bottleneck of existential risk, and maybe that bottleneck involves us getting off planet and moving to other planets. I think that's, despite what Elon Musk says, I'm not sure that's a feasible solution. Certainly not in the next, 100 years or so. Or coming to terms with our problems here, with society's problems, with political problems, with scientific problems, and just, you know, having a real effort to try and fix things. If we can get through that, then, I'm a great believer in humanity. It is difficult sometimes, you know, when you look at the news and you see what happens. But, you know, look at all the people who are trying to fix things, who are trying to make things better. And, you know, we shouldn't, You know, I like to believe that people like that will win the day, and that, you know, humanity can prosper, and we can have a deep future, well into the future. You know, and we've got a whole universe to explore, and the possibilities are, you know, potentially endless. You know, who knows? You know, we're talking about, you know, trying to detect alien civilizations that could be a billion years old. Why can't we get to a billion years old, or 10 billion, yeah, or a trillion? You know, who knows what we'd become? Hopefully it'd be fast for good. But, you know, there's so many possibilities, and it would just be a huge shame if through short-sightedness or through petty hate or greed or whatever that you know, we stopped ourselves achieving, you know, those kind of potentials. And, you know, all it takes is one short-sighted person with power to, you know, to really cause problems. So, yeah, I'm concerned that we're going to do something stupid, but at the same time, you know, if we avoid that, then, you know, the universe is our oyster, and who knows what we can achieve together.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, gosh, Keith, this has been an illuminating conversation. Guys, the book is The Contact Paradox, Challenging Our Assumptions in the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Keith, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.